One of the interesting things about coming back after 12 weeks is you wonder, can I still do this thing? Is this something that I'm still able to do? Now, Wednesday I had at least a test run, and Wednesday went reasonably okay, so we'll see how this morning goes. I think it's kind of like riding a bike. You just get back on, and for the most part, after wibbling about for a bit, you are back to normal. We are looking at a text that actually comes to us by way of the lectionary, and I thought this is a perfect text to come back, because when you spend 12 weeks with yourself, a lot of questions arise. A lot of challenges arise to who you are and what you think you're capable of and what resources you might have at your avail. And that's one of the things I've wrestled with over my 24 years of ministry, is that sense of a call. And I can tell you, when you have a strong sense of a call, nothing can be more empowering. But when you lose that sense of a call, nothing can be more debilitating. To feel like you just have lost it, or even worse, to feel like you're not up for the call. And that's what's going on in our story. Moses is challenged to do something that he doesn't feel he's capable of doing, and thus he is fearful. And the fear is exposed by his endless array of excuses. I can't do this. I'm not a speaker. Send someone else. Who am I? All of those excuses really meant to justify doing nothing, because that's what our excuses are about. They are rational ways to squirm out of doing what we really are called to do. Moses does that because he's not quite sure whether he's up for the call. About 20 years ago, I was teaching a group of singles at College Park Church in Indianapolis. I had a large singles group, and on Wednesday nights, we were going through some lesson, and I'll never forget this, because immediately following the lesson, a tall young man who came regularly, his name is David, and he's now a pastor. And I won't say his last name, because he's a good guy, he's a quiet guy, but he was tall, he's well-built, he's a guy that could easily take me if he wanted. He came up very quickly after the service and did this to me, which I've only experienced twice in my entire ministry. He did this. Who are you to be telling us this? Who are you to be going against? And the real issue was I had taken on one of his seminary profs. One of his professors, Donald Carson, had said something, and I was taking it on, and he said, who are you to disagree with this seminary professor? He knows way more than you. He studied more than you, so who are you to do this? And I was quite intimidated. I felt a little threatened, but he'd never done this before. He was a quiet guy, pretty much a gentle giant. And so, in an unusual moment of boldness, because this doesn't happen to me often, I don't think well on my feet, I replied by, I'll tell you who I am. I'm your pastor. And he's not. D.A. Carson is not your pastor. I am. And so since I'm your pastor, and I'm concerned for you, and I'm given charge over your soul, and I'm called to help transform you into the likeness of Christ, you ought to seriously consider what I've just said. Now keep in mind, I was young in my pastorate. I was cocky. I was bold. I had a chip on my shoulder. And what I said came from a sense of a call, but it was a weak sense of a call, because I was still too green. I was too naive, and really, I could have responded so much differently to that than I did. And I want to share with you how I would respond to that now at the end of this message. But what I said came from a sense of a call, but I wish it had come from a stronger sense of a call, because when you're first answering a call, you feel anxious. You feel like maybe you're not the one that should be doing this. So when he gave these accusations accompanied with the staccato of, who are you? Part of me was hearing that as, you're right. Who am I? And so I made up for it by attacking him back. You see, 30 years ago, I came to Christ at age 22. And during my first years, I wanted to understand my faith. So I read through the Bible again and again. I took copious notes. I read all the books that I could get my hands on. I've always been a curious cat. And I'm reading and reading and reading. And as I'm reading, I start realizing, boy, it'd be fun to share this with people. And so I started having small group studies in my home, and I would share what I was learning with other people. And over the course of time, the pastor of the church I was attending hired me to be his assistant, hired me to be there and to represent him when he was gone and to be there to support him when he was present. My whole goal in reading and studying was to be a Bible professor. That's what I thought would be the easiest road to hoe, because quite frankly, pastoring at that time felt very threatening. I mean, pastoring's where you're in the rough and the warp and woof of what church is involved in. Bible professor, you can stand in your ivory tower and make pronouncements, and you don't have a congregation that really has to address you or challenge you. So I was hoping to be a Bible professor, but as I began working as the assistant to the pastor, I started feeling a sense of a call. And I was told by others, you're helping us, you're benefiting us, maybe you are called. And so I began to embrace that sense of a call, but because I was young and green, I embraced it with a cocky confidence. That kind of confidence that knows all the answers, that's out to make the church ideal. You know, you're the one chosen to fix the church. And I had that confidence, but under the surface, under that surface of cold cockiness, was this lurking sense, who am I to be doing God's work? Who am I to be leading God's people? That's why I relate to Moses here, because that's what he does in verse 11. If you look at verse 11, Moses says to God, who am I? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? You see, Moses encounters this strange occurrence, this bush that is on fire and yet it's not burning. He hears the voice of the divine cry out, Moses, Moses. He answers that call and he's told to take off the sandals that he has because he's on holy ground. And he is now encountering the holy, holy, holy God, the God who is set apart, distinct, unique. The God who is creator and he's mere creature. The God who is transcendent and he's just a man. And so in that context, he encounters this holiness of God, but he encounters something that's beautiful about God. And you'll notice it in verse 7. Then the Lord said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I've heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings. And this is God saying, I know their hurt. I sympathize with their hurt. I empathize with it. I've entered into their hurt. I've heard them cry. I see their suffering and I want to do something about it. So this holy transcendent God is imminently concerned about the hurts and the oppression of people. And so God has a plan to do something. And that plan is in verse 8. Verse 8, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians. And if I were Moses, at that point, I would have said, that's a good plan. That's a really good plan. You come down and deliver them from the Egyptians. But as the discussion goes on, he realizes the plan is a little bit more than that. Look at verse 10, because you can connect 8 with 10. So come, God says, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. So look at verse 8. I've come down to deliver them out of the Egypt. So come, verse 10, I'll send you to bring my people out of Egypt. Well, those are two totally different plans. First one is God says, I'm going to do it. But the way God says God is going to do it is, I'm going to do it through you, Moses. You're going to be my instrument to lead the people out of Egypt. And that's when Moses' excuses begin. Verse 11, who am I? Who am I? I'm nobody. And he'll go on and on with different excuses. He has good reason to be fearful. I would be. He is being challenged to go against the greatest power that exists in his day. Egypt dominated. They were the greatest world power. It would be like me receiving a message where I tell you this morning, hey, God has called me to go and have a word with Donald Trump. Or if you like him, go back. God has called me to have a word with Obama. And he'd say, who are you? Who are you to go speak to these people who are in charge of the ways of the world? You're a nobody. And Moses knows that. He is a nobody now. He's retired. He's a shepherd. He's 80. He's actually tried to deliver the Israelites and failed. You may recall when he was a young man, he saw his brothers being oppressed and he went out and murdered an Egyptian. And then he was run off. He had to run off. And so he's tried before. He's failed. He's now retired. This is a dangerous, dangerous call. And that's why he says, you know, who am I? And God responds in verse 12 with this. I'm not concerned with who you are, Moses. I'm concerned that you understand this. Verse 12, I will be with you. And that thus leads Moses to say, well, who are you? And that leads to that beautiful sacred tetragrammaton. I love to say that because it justifies my seminary education. The sacred tetragrammaton, which is the four-letter name for God, which is the covenant keeping name of God. It's the YHWH, which is unpronounceable, and Jews won't pronounce it. Protestants tend to give it their best go. Yahweh. That Yahweh, the covenant-keeping God, is going to be with them. And so when Moses says, "What's your name?" God says in verse 14, "This is my name, Yahweh." Or, "I am who I am," or "I am that I am," or "I'll be what I'll be." Or you quite simply say, "God will be God." Which isn't that helpful. You know, it's a bit of an ambiguous name that I am who I am, but yet this I am is the I am who has been in relationship with God's people from the beginning. And thus, verse 15, "Thus you shall say to the Israelites, Yahweh." See that capital L-O-R-D? Anytime you see all caps, that's Yahweh, the covenant-keeping name of God. So Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, the God who was with Abraham and told him he would be a promised people who'd bring blessing to the nations, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, "He has sent me to you, and this is my name forever and for all the future, my title for all generations." So God's answer to Moses' sense of inadequacy is to say, "I don't want to wrestle with who you are. I want to tell you who I am. And I am that I am, and I am will be with you. I will be with you in all I do." And that's meant to help him with his sense of inadequacy and with his fears and worries. Now, most of us wrestle with some sense of fear and inadequacy. I would suggest in all but the most egotistical, there's always a small voice in everything you do, even when you do it successfully, that says, "Who are you? Who are you to be doing this?" For a pastor particularly, who are you to serve God? Who are you to lead God's people? What happens if you fail? Maybe you really don't have what it takes. Surely someone else could do it better. And whatever task we've been given, the greater the task, the more inadequate we feel. And there's such a large call in leading and serving God's people. And so from that sense of inadequacy and fear, what we tend to do is make excuses. Because excuses justify doing nothing. "Well, since I can't fix it, I'll do nothing. Since I really can't do much to change this, I'll do nothing at all. Since I don't know if I have all that's necessary to fulfill this call, I just won't even take one step toward trying to do it." And excuses are always an attempt to rationalize doing nothing. And that's why we could learn much from Moses here, because the common denominator in all his excuses is, "I don't have the resources to do what you've called me to do. I can't speak. I can't lead. Who am I? Send someone else." Where God says, "I don't want you to think about your resources. I want you to think about my presence. I want you to think about my resources, the great I am, the Holy One in whose presence you now are standing, that you've been called by the divine to do something that certainly is beyond your capabilities. And yet, it's through you that I'm going to do it. I will come down and deliver the Egyptians. I'll send you to deliver the Egyptians." We are inadequate for the task. We never are up to snuff. And that's perhaps something we need to be at peace with. In first service, we have two scripture readings. And the other scripture reading we read is from Paul, where Paul is talking about his ministry under the new covenant in light of Christ. And he says, "Such is the confidence that we have through Christ toward God. Not that we are competent or adequate of ourselves to claim anything as coming from us, but our competence or adequacy comes from God." I love that verse. It helps me. Because Paul, I would suggest, the greatest missionary you'll ever meet. If you read the book of Acts, which we're studying Wednesday nights, you realize this guy is an action hero without equal. He is bold. He does some amazing things. And yet, at the root of his sense of a call is this awareness, "I'm not competent. I'm inadequate." And yet the call remains, and the adequacy will come from God. The good news is that God uses our inadequacy, and perhaps the only thing God can't use is a heart that's so proud and full of itself that feels like it's entitled to leadership that God really can't break in. I was Comforted by this quote, Mandy Smith, I read a number of books over the summer. One of them was The Vulnerable Pastor, and she says, "When we see the ridiculous disparity between our skill and the great need, there's nothing for it but to laugh, throw up our hands and declare, 'I'm so unfit, it's funny. The need is so huge, only God can fill it. Therefore, we have no choice but to trust Him.'" I would suggest one of the clearest indications we're following God's call is that we recognize that we are incompetent, we are inadequate, we're insufficient. Because it's only when we recognize that that we're ready to lean on the sufficiency and the adequacy and the competence of the great I Am. I find it very comforting to know if we feel inadequate, if you feel inadequate, well, you're in good company. Moses was there. Paul was there. I'm there, probably not as much as I should be, but I'm there on many occasions. And the bigger the task, the greater the sense of inadequacy. But never forget this promise. God is able to do exceedingly abundantly beyond all that you ask or think or imagine. That God is able, and our call is just simply to answer the call. To say, "Here I am. I know I'm not adequate. I know I'm not competent. I know there are better people that could do this. But I'm the best I guess you got at this moment. And I do know that my call is to answer faithfully." Which takes me back to close to my chest-thumping parishioner. I'd handle him differently now. He's a wonderful man, and so there's nothing against him. He will be one of the only two people that ever thumped my chest like that. And I think out of those two, I like him better than the other person, but that's another story. But I would handle it differently now. And those of you who know me after 24 years of ministry know that I would handle it differently. Instead of immediately responding with, you know, "No, I'm right, you need to listen to me," I would instead say, "You know, I may be wrong, Dave. I mean, I'm doing the best I can. That's all you can ask of me. I'm doing the best I can. I'm offering the best answer I can at this moment. I'm not saying it's the final word, and I may be wrong." And I would be able to say that because I'm more confident of God's call now than I was there in my early years. And being confident of the call, I can now say with boldness, "Yeah, I'm inadequate. I don't have all the answers. I may be wrong, but I'm still your pastor. I'm still called to love you and to serve you. And one of the ways is to show you in humility, well, I'm just doing the best I can." Give me the benefit of knowing that and assuming I'm doing the best I can. You see, in my early years, when I answered God's call, I was fearful to answer it, afraid that I was moving into area I shouldn't go, that I shouldn't be following God's call. Now, 24 years into it, I'm fearful of not answering the call. Back then, I was afraid I was doing something I shouldn't be doing in answering God's call. Now I'm afraid that I won't do what I should do because I've been called and you've been called. And we all have a special call. We all have some unique vocation that God has invited to us to. And what we ought to be more afraid of is that we don't answer it faithfully. And we can say that because we're more confident than ever as we walk along this journey of faith. That the I Am is with us. With every inadequacy I've experienced, God has made up for it. God has smoothed it over. God has helped me make a way. God has shown paths. God has brought people. God has brought gifts. God has shown God's self faithful if I'm just willing to take the charge and to answer the call. So I want to close with this great quote from a book called Ministry Mantras. It's just axioms for ministry. And in this book, the author writes, "The fact is that there are no successful churches. There are instead communities of sinners gathered before God week after week in towns and villages all over the world. In these community of sinners, one of the sinners is called pastor and given a designated responsibility in the community. The pastor's responsibility is to keep the community attentive to God. So my job, at its root, is to say, you know, whatever we have, whatever the call, whatever anxieties, whatever fears, whatever excuses we give, I Am is with us. Don't forget that. My call, if nothing else, is to constantly do what very few others in our world, commercials, TV, advertisements, media, they aren't doing this. They're not saying, look to God. They're not saying, yeah, you feel inadequate, you are, but God is sufficient. God is able. And that to me is a beautiful call and a beautiful witness, and I embrace it wholeheartedly. And I pray that you'll pray for me to that end, that I'll keep doing this with you, pointing to God, saying that the I Am is with us. Let's move forward with boldness and confidence. Well, I want to close with this. This is just a responsive reading I'd like you to share with me. It's essentially Moses' excuses with God, and you will take the role of the excuser, and I'll take the role of God. And I'll join you in the last one because I'm also an excuser. But if you'll read what's bold and in yellow, and read it with some gumption, all right? With the kind of passion that comes from an excuser, because we don't do excuses like, well, who am I? We do excuses like, who am I? All right? The Lord said to me, go.
I said, who will
be? Very good. And God said, yes, you. But I answered, and the Lord said, you're stalling. The Lord said, go. And I answered,
the Lord answers when I fail. I don't have what it takes. What will the Lord say? Send someone else.
And the Lord said, stop wriggling. The Lord said, go. And I said, and the Lord said, do you think I'll be far away? And the Lord said, go. And I shrugged. And I said, okay, Lord, have it your way. Here I am. Send me. Join me in prayer. Gracious God, we hear your call. We ask that you would give us ears to hear, that you would give us a boldness and faith to recognize that you have not called us because we are better than or greater than or more spiritual than anyone else, but that you've called us because we are here to listen. You have called us to do something greater than we can do on our own because you have promised your liberating and life-giving presence. Give us boldness in that presence. Make us aware that you are always with us. You, the great I Am, the thrice holy one, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Assuage our anxieties and fears. Keep us from excuses that justify our inaction. Help us to learn how to be your hands and feet in this broken world.